Good evening. I hope everybody is well, that you're enjoying the 3 weeks, that I hope you utilize the meditations from the IRE that are on the website. Please join us in saying the Anabakoa. Anabakoa. Gedula chemincha tati serura alafet gimel yutav tzadik kaberinat amcha sagvenu taharenu no Fresh iron, Sintet Nun. Na Gibor, Dor Shehud Ha, Kevava, Shamrem. Nun Gimodalad Yud Kafshin. Barhen Tacharem, Rakame Sitkacha, Tamim. Gamlin. Betet Resh, Saditav Gimel. Chasim Kadosh, Berov Tucha, Na'el Adatach. Het Kuf Bet, Tet Nunayim. Yachid Geye, Lamcha Penei, Zokre Kedushata Yud Gimel Lamed Pei Zayin Kuf Shavatenu Kabel Ushmati Atatenu Yodea Talumot Shin Kufav Sari Yud Taf. The Taf is the letter that created the constellation, the planet Lavana, the planet, the moon, the planet with no light of its own. And the Chet that created the constellation Sartan, the crab, or the cancer. And it's also the Chet created the Hebrew month of Tammuz. In the eighth verse, we say in a whisper, as I have explained, the I'm sorry for the interruption. I was looking for a particular thing. As I have explained, there's only six verses from the Zohar during this first week associated with Matot, the parasha of the week. There is no Zohar for next week, the parasha of Matai, or Masai, which includes a connection to the Anabakoach and the 42-letter name because of the 42 journeys of the Jewish people in the desert. And also, the Parasha of Devarim has no direct Zohar, although Rabbi Ashlag has revealed that in the Parasha of Balak, there is a revelation, there is some Zohars appropriate in explaining the Parasha of Devarim. But it's basically the whole idea that during this three-week period, we need to be dealing with other issues. And that is why the Zohar is so concealed in this period. So rather than concentrating on the Zohar, which is very important and highly recommended that you do every day, from the daily Zohar or from another section of the Zohar, the prologue is a good one, and also the parsha of Hazinu, which has a fairly lengthy section of Zohar. But the real recommended study during this three-week period is anything having to do with the temple and having us explain and mourn for the temple, but at the same time that we're mourning, the more we study about the temple, according to what we read yesterday, God has said that the study of the temple will be as if we have built the temple. And that there are some views and some opinions that the temple doesn't have to physically manifest, but that we can do it through the consciousness of mind over matter. And that the more we study about it, the more we learn to appreciate what we have lost by having the temple gone and destroyed. That this is all part of the process, as part of God's plan to be bringing the Mashiach and bringing the Age of Peace and bringing all of the things that we all say we cherish and want and desire. Although there's always the question of the difference between saying it and doing something about it. So I am continuing to read from the organization Azamra.org, a translation of the Secrets of the Third Temple, which is the English title of a English translation of the Hebrew book written by Chaim Luzzatto, talking about the Third Temple. So we have reached this section, and we're just talking about the forewords and the areas of preparation to give us a background to understand what the Third Temple is all about. So we're reading this section called the Ezekiel's Vision. In the 25th year of our exile, on the new year, on the 10th day of the month, in the 14th year after the city was struck, on this very day the hand of God was upon me, and he brought me there. In visions of God he brought me to the land of Israel and set me down upon a very high mountain, where there was a likeness of a city to the south. And he brought me there, and behold, there was a man whose appearance was like the appearance of brass, with a cord of linen in his hand and a measuring rod. And he stood in the gate. And the man said to me, Son of man, see with your eyes and hear with your ears, and set your heart on all that I will show you. For it is in order to show you that you have been brought here. Declare all that you see to the house of Israel. This is Ezekiel chapter 40, verse 1 to 4. And as we had discussed earlier in this writings, Ezekiel's initial response 14 years earlier, approximately, when God said to him, make sure the people of Israel prophesies to them, tell them about the temple, have them be aware of its measurements, have them be aware of every aspect of the temple. And Ezekiel's response was, we're in exile. Wait till you return us, and then tell us about this, and I'll tell them then. But right now, what are they supposed to do? They can't build the temple, they're in exile. And the exile was caused by their sins. And all of this is true. And it's really an amazing response. What God chose to respond to Ezekiel in the Midrash that I'm describing. It's really an indication of God's mercy. Here we are as the people of Israel, having created this condition where the temple needed to be destroyed so that the people didn't need to be destroyed. God allowed his house to be destroyed in order to make sure the people were not destroyed. Think of the sin was involved in this. And then what does he say? There's really no issue for you people. The temple's destroyed, but study it. If you study it, I will make it as if you had built it. Think of God's mercy, what that is really talking about. And here again, 14 years later, he's showing Ezekiel a vision of the temple. And Ezekiel is recording it. This is what we're reading. Shortly after the destruction of the first temple, the prophet Ezekiel saw a vision of the third temple with all its buildings, gateways, and courtyards in all their details. The entire vision is recorded in the book of Ezekiel from chapter 40, verse 1 to chapter 43, verse 17. This is an apparent contradiction in the opening verse of this prophecy, which dates it on the new year, on the 10th day of the month. The rabbis taught in which year is that new year celebrated on the 10th of Tishrei, and not at its usual time on the 1st of that month. This was the Jubilee year, the 50th year in the count of sabbatical years. 14 years after the destruction of the temple, and 25 years after the exile of Jehoiachin. The Jubilee, and this will continue and explain it, so I'll probably just read it, but the Jubilee is an amazing, amazing year. And we're having this whole discussion because in the Jubilee year, there is a unique event where Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, Yom Kippur kind of come together, and maybe it'll explain it, maybe it won't. But we have to understand there's something wrong in this prophecy because, let me read it again, in the 25th year of our exile, on the 10th day of the month, in the 14th year after the city was struck. Well, how do you have 25 years of an exile and then 14 years after the city was struck? Was there 11 years that the exile was beforehand? Well, that actually there was, because if we read the prophets, it tells us that this king, who was only 8 years old, excuse me, I'm mixing stories, this king, the last king in Judah, was kidnapped and taken to Babylonia 11 years before the city and temple were destroyed. Continuing, the Jubilee year is one of complete redemption, in which all slaves go free, everyone returns to their ancestral lands, and everything begins afresh. In Kabbalistic thought, Yovel, the Jubilee, is associated with the redemptive Sefirah of Binah, understanding, which has 50 gates. There is a 50-year process called Yovel, and there are 50 gates to Bina. And there is this connection, which is not clear and not frequently discussed, but very much part of our background. and we need to have some understanding of this as we go on. In Ezekiel's vision on this auspicious day, he rose in his prophetic bina to a level beyond created space and time. He was thus able to see beyond the second temple that would rise 56 years later. 56 years later, I thought there was 70 years of the exile before the building of the second temple. 70 minus 56 is 14. And this is the 14 years. That had already taken place. So the 56 is correct. He saw beyond its destruction over 400 years afterwards, meaning the second temple was built and then destroyed 430 years later, or 420 years later. So Ezekiel is seeing beyond 420 years, beyond the thousands of years of exile, trials, and tribulations that were to follow. The temple has not been rebuilt. The third temple has not manifested. It's now been 2,500 years approximately. And Ezekiel is being shown a vision of this day that we have not yet arrived at. Ezekiel already saw a vision of the ultimate heavenly temple, which is destined to descend to earth at the climax of history as we know it, and stand eternally on Mount Moriah. Well, I'm not arguing with the rabbi here who's translated this and made this commentary. But the Temple Mount is under dispute. People don't realize this. The Jewish people say the Temple Mount is the Temple Mount and everything's correct. And the Arabs say there is no Jewish presence. And the Temple Mount is not correct. It's in a different location. And I'm not going to go here, go there. I'm not going to enter into this discussion. I have no background in it. But I do have this very clear prophecy. I've read it. It's in the prophets. The heavenly temple is destined to descend to earth. But as we will read later on, it's significantly larger than Temples 1 and 2. Temples 1 and 2 give us dimensions in cubits. Temple 3 gives us dimensions in something 6 times larger than a cubit, something 10 times larger than a cubit, something significantly larger than a cubit, as we will come to read. Ezekiel saw this vision of what is to descend to the earth. Will it arrive on Mount Moriah? Will the Mount, Temple Mount, the top of Mount Moriah, will it expand to accept this a larger dimension? How is that going to work? And yet, there's another prophecy that tells us that the gates of the temple will be created and mounted by man. That the temple is not perfect without man's involvement. But we'll read more about this as we continue. 20 years prior to this vision of the heavenly temple, as Ezekiel stood in exile in Babylon by the side of the river Kvar, the heavens were opened and I saw visions of God. Now that's Ezekiel chapter 1, verse 1. And as we have spoken, we thought prophecy could not happen outside of Israel. And yet God in his mercy said to Ezekiel, here is your vision, here's the prophecy. Make sure the people know that they will be redeemed. Make sure they know that this is not the end as they feel that it is. Make sure they know there will be another temple and a third one. And some people say a fourth, because the Greek interruption of the second temple before it was destroyed by the Romans, some people consider that a destruction and renewal, rebuilding. But we'll not address that question. This was when Ezekiel saw the Merkabah, the chariot, with which God governs the world. The storm wind, fire, brightness, chayot, and ofanim that Ezekiel saw all exist in heaven, wherever that may be. Only at rare moments, however, does a tiny chink open in the thick clouds of concealment that hide the spiritual worlds from normal human consciousness, affording outstanding masters of the spirit a brief glimpse beyond time and space into the inner workings of the universe. And actually, there are many books describing all of this. What opening comes from one level, the chayot from another level, the storm wind, the fire, and the brightness represents different worlds. All of this comes through the study of Kabbalah. Everything that Ezekiel saw, Isaiah also saw. But Ezekiel was like a villager who saw the king, while Isaiah was like a big city dweller who saw the king. This is a comment from the Talmud from the book of Chagiga, which is the location in the Talmud where the discussion of the four who entered the Pardes, the four who entered the garden, comes. Discussing about the different relationships, the different aspects of Torah that needs to be studied. This rabbinic comment offers insight into why Ezekiel's visions, such as those of the chariot and heavenly temple, are described in such graphic detail, in contrast to Isaiah's. Several generations prior to Ezekiel, Isaiah attained even higher levels of prophecy, having been in the land of Israel when the first temple stood in all its glory. Isaiah too saw the chariot and the heavenly temple, as is his first vision, which opens with the words, I saw God sitting upon a throne, high and lofty, and his train filled with the temple. Isaiah, Ezekiel, and all the prophets saw one and the same God. They saw the same throne of glory and heavenly temple. But Isaiah lived in times which were better and more conducive to exalted spiritual vision. In this sense, Isaiah was like a city dweller who was less easily excited by the glory and bright lights. In Isaiah's time, it was not so necessary to reveal all the details of the vision. There's also other differences between Ezekiel and Isaiah's vision. Isaiah was describing a God that is close to the people. And Ezekiel was describing a God that was imminent from the people, was in heaven while the people were in earth. Isaiah was describing a God that both was in the earth and in the heaven at the same time. The visions are mutually exclusive. There are aspects that are similar. We need to learn more. We need to understand more. But let's continue. However, by Ezekiel's time, the people were in exile under foreign rule. many were increasingly assimilated and cut off from the ancestral vision that had been transmitted from generation to generation. Ever since the entire Jewish people prophetically glimpsed into the heavens as they crossed the Red Sea, and when they stood at Sinai, precisely because the people were now in exile and on a lower spiritual level, it was necessary to fuel the vision and keep it alive. And divine providence decreed that Ezekiel be granted prophecy, even in exile, and that he should record it and transmit what he saw. And we have experienced God's mercy yet again. Moving along to the next commentary. The next section is titled The Kabbalah Tradition, and it's explaining what we will come to find out. And I'm sure I won't have time to read all of it, but let's see. When Ezekiel stood at the banks of the river Kfar and saw the heavenly chariot, it was a vision of the same heavenly order that had existed continuously from long, long before. The Hebrew word Kfar, in fact, means before or already. When Ezekiel looked up at the sky, he saw the same stars and constellations at which Abraham had gazed. When the skies and heavens opened up for Ezekiel, giving him a glimpse of the realm beyond physical space and time, it was through his use of methods of prophetic prayer and meditation that also went back to the author of the Sefer Yetzirah. Now, I'm going to be starting to teach the Sefer Yetzirah this coming Monday at 7 o'clock West Coast time. And I'm going to try and teach both aspects of the Sefer Yetzirah, that of a book of astrology, the science of astrology, and that of the book of meditative technique, that of the book to give you a personal experience of the Creator. I don't think it's ever been done in that way, to try and do both at the same time, and I'm not sure that I'm up to it. It's up to Hashem whether I will succeed. But it's important that people understand that the Sefer Yetzirah has these two different aspects and many more. And we will discuss that in greater depth and discussion this coming Monday. Abraham searched for the power source behind the manifest plurality of the world led him to the underlying coordinates and elements of creation, as expressed in the letters of the Alphabet. From earliest childhood, Abraham had faith that all the different powers in creation are interconnected as part of a single, unified, purposeful system of order. The stars and planets are governed by angels, which in turn are governed by higher angels. Everything in creation is a manifestation of the power of the Sefirot, which are the ultimate coordinates and elements of creation, brought into being through the Word of God. The letters of the Alphabet and their combinations, the purpose of Abraham's letter manipulations, was to connect with the Creator and harness the power of the letters so as to channel beneficial influences to the world. What did Abraham teach in the Sefer Yetzirah? How to manipulate letters, how to utilize the letters, how to build words. Words of two letters is still a word. Words of two letters that have no meaning in the Hebrew language is still a word. discuss that more on Monday. Abraham transmitted his wisdom to Isaac, who taught it to Jacob. Jacob transmitted it to his sons, and especially Levi, who became chief guardian of the tradition. Levi passed it on to his son Kehat, who passed it on to his son Amram. And Amram was father of the Lord of all the prophets, Moses. The plan of creation is that God should be revealed to all his creatures on all levels. Moses' greatness lay in his power to rise to the highest levels of prophecy ever achieved and bring his vision down so as to make it accessible to people on far lower levels. Thus, Moses brought the children of Israel to a state where at the crossing of the Red Sea, a simple maid saw more than Ezekiel, while at the giving of the Torah at Sinai, God opened up all seven heavens to the children of Israel. Everybody was a prophet. Everybody will return to being a prophet at the parting of the Red Sea. Will the Red Sea happen again? The limitation that is represented by the Yam Suf, the Sea of End, that limitation has to be removed again. And how is that going to be removed? By people having the consciousness that it can be removed. Moses brought the people across that limitation, and they reached a level of prophecy higher than Ezekiel. What does that mean? Until you've had a personal experience of Hashem, it cannot be expressed in words, only in pictures. Only in pictures that can be exchanged one mind to another. The soul of the Torah revealed at Sinai was the prophetic vision of the inner workings of the universe, together with the prayer power it gives to those who attain it. The sanctuary that Moses built and the temple that later took its place stand at the center of the Torah system as a holographic model of those inner workings and the principal focus of devotion and prayer. At the peak of Jewish life in Israel, prophecy, which was integrally bound up with the temple in Jerusalem, could almost be said to have been a national occupation. The Talmud states that millions of people practiced prophecy in biblical times. This statement is so unbelievable when compared to the history that is described. The rabbi is even afraid to specify and quote the Talmud directly because it says 3 million people studied to be a prophet. There were schools of prophet. Each school taught its own technique. Each school taught a technique to see what one could see, to hear what one could hear, to taste and smell and touch what one could taste and smell and touch. This technique was taught, and then only those people who had prepared themselves could then be touched to become a prophet. It was a national pastime because that's our job. And the temple is intimately connected to the concept of prayer. The Jewish people intimately connected to the concept of prayer, but still so far distant from where we were before in this connection. We'll talk more about it in the various classes that I teach. This sentence, the soul of the Torah revealed at Sinai was the prophetic vision of the inner workings of the universe, which together with the prayer power gives to those who attain it. What's the cause and what's the effect? Even the rabbi, I think, is saying it in the wrong direction. Those who attain this level of consciousness have learned to manifest with their words, their prayer power, this prophetic vision. They make it happen. They have been delegated by the Creator to make it happen with their words. But with the moral degeneration that started to set in, the pursuit of prophecy began to be abused by false prophets and practitioners of foreign cults. The voice of true prophecy was increasingly forced to become that of reproof, while faithful practitioners of Abraham's methods of prayer power had to conceal much of their knowledge from the wider public. Well, they didn't succeed too well. Well, what is a false prophet? How do we tell the difference between a false prophet and a true prophet? It's a very simple statement, very simple understanding. And when you hear it, you're going to understand the problem. A false prophet is someone who prophesies something happening, and then that does not happen. That is a false prophet. So if I say, God forbid, God has not spoken to me like this, but I'm using this as an example. God spoke to me and said, tell the people that in 1,000 years, this good thing is going to happen to every human being who's alive at the time. Okay, am I a false prophet or a true prophet? Based on the definition I've given you, you have to wait until it comes to pass. There's no way to know. Now, maybe there's another prophet who can see the movie that I'm describing and say, no, it's not true. But again, the movie he's seeing may be a different movie than I'm seeing. So both could be true. This is the difficulty in knowing who is a false prophet. Now imagine a situation where you have kings and queens with plenty of money, plenty of power, plenty of influence, and they go to a man who says he's a prophet. And they say, I really want to hear you prophesize these good things that I want to have happen. And here is a comfortable living for the rest of your life. How many people are strong enough to resist this influence? Because even if they don't do it, it still influences them. It still becomes a false prophecy, even if they say it's not true. Because just as science teaches today, the observer and the observed are intimately connected. Who is a false prophet? How do you tell? Is very much an important aspect of what we are studying here. Thus it was the mystical dimension of the Torah tended to become hidden from view, leaving meticulous study and observance of the outer forms of the law as the distinguishing hallmark of Judaism in the eyes of the majority of Jews and Gentiles alike. That's an amazing statement. Who is a Jew? Someone who does these outer trappings, of course. Not true. Nevertheless, the mystical tradition or Kabbalah was pursued in a continuous tradition from biblical times onwards. Key figures in the transmission of the Oral Torah from David, Solomon, Ezra, and the men of the Great Assembly to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Rabbi Akiva, and the other great Talmudic sages were at the same time supreme masters of mystical wisdom and devotion. Ma'aseh Bereshit, the work of creation, dealing with the secrets of creation, and something that could only be taught to two students at a time. And Ma'aseh Merkavah, the work of the chariot, which is more concerned with devotion, meditation, and prophecy, with it, and also only can be taught to one student, and that student had to be wise on his own. These were the two main branches of the esoteric wisdom pursued in the private study chambers of the sages of Israel. However, in the public study halls and synagogues, it was the revealed Torah of practical observance and moral improvement that was stressed. While the secrets of Torah were hinted at elusively in the word plays and parables of Midrash, and also in those word plays, not only did they allude to the surface level, they also alluded to the mystical level. And it's all there in black and white. All you have to do is understand the code. A body cannot live without a soul. The outer body of Torah law is truly alive only when it has inner spiritual meaning. The destruction of the Second Temple in the time of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and the intensification of the exile under ruthless Roman persecution turned the Jewish dream into a horrendous nightmare. Precisely then, divine providence decreed that the esoteric wisdom of the Torah should begin to shine forth beyond the confines of closed circles in order to sustain the nation and advance the world towards the ultimate goal. We were told, stop hiding it. 2,000 years ago, at the time of the destruction of the Second Temple, we were told to stop hiding it. And that's why the Talmud wrote it down. And written into the codes of the Talmud is the mystical tradition. Just have to learn to study it differently than it's being taught today. The most Kabbalistic book ever written is the Talmud. But nobody thinks that. Nobody wants to learn it that way. Nobody is being taught to study it that way. Which way are they being taught to study it? Memorizing. So much available. All we have to do is break our patterns. The tribulations of exile have characterized many of the historical periods in which the secret wisdom of the Kabbalah was successfully revealed to ever wider circles. This was the case in the 16th century, in the chaotic aftermath of the expulsion of the Jews from Spain. It was then that an influx of sages to the holy city of Sfat in the Galilee made it the center from which the Kabbalah, especially that of Rabbi Isaac Luria, the Ari, began to spread forth to the entire world. The teachings of the Ari were put in writing by his outstanding student, Rabbi Chaim Vital in Etz Chaim, The Tree of Life, and numerous other volumes. What emerges is most complex, subtle, highly ramified system of multiple categories, subcategories, holy names, and devotions. The writings of the Ari contain all the keys to the celestial vision of Kabbalah, as witnessed at Sinai and by all the prophets and embedded in the Bible, Midrash, Talmud, and Zohar. And despite the increasing availability of Kabbalistic literature, anyone who wanted to grasp the system required vast scholarship as well as strong resolve. But despite the increasing, there was no such thing as an introductory primer. The Zohar and the writings of the Ari are voluminous and highly diffuse. In both cases, the way the teachings are presented presupposes a grasp of the entire system. Even experienced Talmudists are likely to find these works quite baffling without the help of a reliable guide. That's the end of the Kabbalah section in preparation to study the secrets of the Third Temple. But let me explain it in more explicit language. You need a teacher to study Kabbalah. That teacher does not necessarily have to be a physical entity, but you need a teacher. The Ari put his teachings to Rabbi Chaim Vital, who wrote the book Et Chaim, which all of the Kabbalists of the last 500 years have studied. And what they've studied was not understandable, because the Ari said, I will return and I will rearrange my teachings so that it's understandable. And that is what Rabbi Ashlag said he did in his Esser Sefirot, a book that I will start teaching in 1 or 2 weeks. Rabbi Ashlag rearranged the Etz Chaim so that it is understandable. And that book is called the Esser Sefirot. He rearranged it, he made commentary on it, and it is clear. It needs to be understood. It needs to be studied. But only within the context of the Zohar. Only within the context of other teachings. Only within the context of a teacher. Who is my teacher? I'm not sure that I have a teacher. But I do know that I am supposed to be teaching what I am teaching, or that I would get the message to stop. If you're going to ask who is your teacher, I'm not the right teacher for you. If what I teach does not resonate with you as truth, I'm not the right teacher for you. The Ari is not understandable as it is known And when this rabbi has said that the Talmudists don't understand it, there are repeated stories of great Talmudists who started to study Zohar and found that they couldn't understand a word. I have a personal experience with a Talmudist who knows it backwards and forwards, upside down and roundabout, who said to me, "I tried to study Zohar and I could not understand a word." At the time he said it to me, I didn't understand what he was saying. Not everybody is privileged to study Kabbalah. But those of us who are privileged to study Kabbalah have a great and important role to play in the revelation of prophecy and in the revelation of the third temple, and in the revelation of the plan of the Creator. Come join me every afternoon during the 3 weeks, Monday to Thursday, 5 p.m. Los Angeles time, 10 p.m. Los Angeles time, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Come join me. Come join me as we study the Sefer Yetzirah. Monday nights at 7 p.m. L.A. time, West Coast time. Come join me as we start to study other writings of Rabbi Ashlag, who has reorganized the Etz Chaim. Come study with us. Come experience with us. Come accept your responsibility. I wish you all well. I remind you to do the meditation every morning, 3 times a day if you can and are willing to, as you learn to pray properly, as you learn to manifest. Good night, all. Are there any questions? No questions. Have a beautiful evening. And we will start in the next section of this beautiful English translation, The Secrets of the Third Temple, tomorrow at 5 p.m.